Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, whenever most people think about Jews and world wars, it's usually about World War II. However, today is different, and that's because my guest is award-winning author Jane Loeb Rubin, and she's author of the novel Over There. It's the third installment of her best-selling Gilded City trilogy, which illustrates a little-known chapter of Jewish American history and set during World War I with striking relevance for today. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Jane, go to janeloebrubin.com and follow her on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me.
Absolutely. How did you get started on the path to writing?
I'd always enjoyed writing. And in 2009, I wrote a cancer memoir after being diagnosed with a deadly cancer that I still am in treatment for. And the memoir was a recommendation from one of the social workers who thought it might help me cope with the ongoing treatment. And lo and behold, I got a lot better. And 10 years passed, and then I retired. And when I retired, I decided that I really wanted to explore the genesis of my illness, which was genetically linked. It was a BRCA1 mutation. And it led me to my great-grandmother, Matilda. And so her name had been forgotten in history. She was a Jewish immigrant, German Jewish immigrant in 1966, a year after the Civil War ended. And she had no real history, just a few facts. So I felt that in her honor, I had been raising money for ovarian cancer research for the last 10 years, but I wanted to give her a life and I wanted to honor women like her who died young and whose names were forgotten.
How did you go about your research? Did you have people you could talk to within the family that gave you some ways to go? Or did you go to Ancestry.com as a lot of people do? Or how did you do the research?
Well, there were two categories of research. One was family research, and that was easy. There was very little. So I had just a few facts. The second area of research was research about the time and the context of the story I wrote. And that was much easier because I did basically New York City research, books, online research. I live near New York City, so I had the advantage of going to the Lower East Side, going to the Historical Museum, going to the Jewish archives that I could find there. So it was a combination of all those things. Most of the story is fiction.
Right. And I generally don't interview or talk with fiction writers per se, but your particular story fascinated me, just how you wove in World War I, the Jewish background, and your own story and your own history and why you started writing. So this became, and this is not, you're not done writing this trilogy. It become, what do you call it when it's four books? If three books is a trilogy. What's four books?
A tetralogy.
Wow. Yeah.
Or for those of us who have to think before we can recall that word, a series.
I like that. Yes, I'll go with series. No, that makes sense.
I'm going with series too.
Yeah, very good.
And I had to think for a minute if I could remember the word.
No, that's fine. Now, your earlier works were In the Hands of Women, which is a historical novel set in the 1900s. And then you had the other one, which was
Threadbare.
Right. There you go. Threadbare. So now this is the new one, and it takes place during World War I. And of course, the title is a reference to a song called Over There, which is very popular during that time. Did you find that when you were doing research in today's world, of course, you mentioned about going to various physical libraries and collections and stuff, but I would imagine a lot of stuff you could do online at this point in terms of research, I mean.
Yes. So the information about my great-grandmother, Matilda Tilly, is really in reference to Threadbare, which is the first book in the series. And that book established the characters and the family that traveled into In the Hands of Women, and then later were in France during World War I. So now we're in World War I, and the research on that war was way more extensive because I really didn't know a great deal about World War I. I had a photograph of one of my grandfathers who fought in the war, and I had two Jewish grandfathers who I don't know if they were conscripted or whether they enlisted, but both grandfathers went.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the novel itself, your next one, because you're in World War I now, is the next one going to be World War II?
No, the next one is the 1920s. Its working title is The Hat Trick. It takes the surviving members of the family to the farms in Sullivan County in Hudson Valley, where the original farm from Threadbare went when Harlem was leveled. So they're in Hudson Valley. It's the Prohibition. The KKK is there, believe it or not. And Dutch Schultz has a brewery up there. So it has all the makings for a really fun novel.
How long did it take you to write over there?
About a year. And I'm a very, and a lot of people ask me about this because I really wasn't a career writer. I was a healthcare executive for my career. And as such, I had a very structured work life. So it was easy for me to just bring that forward when I decided I really wanted to get serious about writing and I started getting contracts. So I had deadlines. And as a matter of fact, I have an Excel spreadsheet that tracks my pages and how many pages a week I need to produce to get to a point where I can have enough time to read the book through and make changes before I submit it. So I can work on a novel in a year if I have at least a loose idea of what I want the story to be about.
You're the most organized writer I've had on the show.
I'm totally crazy. But you know, it's interesting. I'm very organized. I was very type A, so I'm still type A. That doesn't go away. But I get tired in the afternoon from all the medications I take. And so I get up at 5:30 because that's what I did when I was working in the hospitals, because that's when you meet with the docs. And I continue to do that. So by 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm done. You know, some people are just on their second cup of coffee. I'm, winding down the coffee and thinking about what else I want to do that day.
That's interesting in a sense, because you're disciplined, but you have to be, because you are type A, but you have to get the work done. In order to get the work done, you have to, which everybody knows, you have to do it when your energy is there. And when your energy is there because of the medication and when it wanes. So that's fascinating to hear that you have that ongoing discipline to be able to do it. It is. It's a modified type A, isn't it? It's a, what would you call maybe a realistic type A based on energy levels.
Very much realistic. I can talk about my illness in the context of a lot of programs I do. People are very curious about how I could have become a writer after I was already diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Yes, a lot of people, I think if they were given that news, even if they were writers, would say, okay, well, I'm not going to write anymore because I've got to deal with this. But you obviously said, you know what, I'm going to deal with this and also I'm going to change careers.
Well, I had to hit 65 and my doctors were really, they were really encouraging me to slow down, smell the roses. I have 7 grandchildren now. I didn't know if I was going to have any, and I really loved them to pieces. And I was ready. My parents were depression kids, so they taught us to be savers, and I saved. And so I was really prepared to retire at 65. And trust me, you know, as an author, authors don't write for money. There's a few that that make a living out of not a lot.
But it's a love of writing at the same time, books versus articles or essays. A lot more work, a lot more time, a lot more labor invested in a book and then the rewriting of a book in some cases that you need to do because the editor says, well, this part needs to be stronger and this part needs to be weaker, whatever they tell you. Also, when you first started writing, were you optimistic that you would find a publisher, or did you just...
At the time I started, it was very clear to me that I needed to engage in a lot of classes. I was writing in bullet points at work. Nobody wanted adjectives and adverbs. The last thing they wanted to hear was that the neurosurgeon was so angry that spittle was coming out and spraying across the room. I don't think a memo like that would have gone too far. So I had to learn how to allow myself to really expand my writing, understand what readers wanted to hear, what was entertaining, either in a serious way or in a comic way to readers, and the balance between, there's so much Jewish humor, the balance between the humor and the seriousness, the issues of the time, the characters' personalities. And so all of those mechanics were things that I really needed to be taught. And I didn't have time for an MFA, but I probably could have earned one with all the classes I've taken and all the critique groups. So I tried to construct a fast track to teach me and get me at least to a point where I knew what I needed to know in order to create a book that was marketable. And my end goal was not so much to publish with the Big Five, because time has always been a reality for me. And publishing with the Big Five publishing companies takes at least an extra year. So I went with mid-size and small publishing houses where I didn't need an agent and I could streamline the process. And thankfully, my In the Hands of Women was picked up within a month. And then I started getting 2 book deals and 4 book deals from this same publishing company because my books were selling well. And so now I'm working on book 4.
Yeah, that's impressive. Did you ever go back and look at, with your type A personality, look back at what was popular about the first couple of books and why they sold, and then tailor the next book along those lines to make it even more marketable?
Yes and no. So I have a business background. I have an MBA, and I took a lot of classes in marketing. So marketing is an area that most writers are terrified of. Correct. And I have an outgoing personality. I had done a lot of public speaking. Marketing was a challenge that I understood. I didn't have to switch the way I did things, like going from bullets to narrative. I understood marketing. So I knew right away who my target audience was and beyond. And I think that there's some element of sentimentality in my stories. Threadbare in particular goes back to the tenements. And so many people from an immigrant background, and predominantly Jewish, but also non-Jews too, had ancestors who lived in the tenements and who came from Europe during that period of massive immigration. And so they've heard shreds of stories. And so when they're reading my Threadbare, which is really technically the first chronologically in the series, it's evoking a lot of stories that they want to talk about. And they're talking about them to their friends, and the word of mouth that gets out about the book. In the Hands of Women takes place during the turn of the century, when the Comstock laws were in place and birth control was illegal. Abortion was illegal. Birth control was illegal. Women basically had no reproductive rights. And so I finished that book a year before Roe v. Wade was overturned. It was just serendipity. And so when that book came out in the beginning, it appealed to a lot of women's groups. So I had women's groups, I had people in my age group and older, and then I had to make a decision, book 3, which is over there, what time period and what were the social issues I wanted to focus on. And in my heart, having had 2 grandfathers who served, my father was a fighter pilot in World War II in the Pacific. His 2 brothers served in Europe. I needed to understand the Jewish cry in the United States to serve in times of war and world wars. And I really wanted to do it from the medical side because my background and my focus in my books is medical historical fiction. World War I was a time when there was massive innovation in medicine because of the number of casualties, and they were learning. They had X-ray in the field hospitals. They had transfusions. They had ambulances. These are things that were never before used at wartime. And the more I started reading about it, the more a really great story came to me. And so I chose to depart from the sentimentality and really take a chance with my readership and challenge them to learn a little bit about World War I as I did, because trust me, I didn't really understand at the time why the U.S. got in the war. I mean, we went in 3 years into the war, and most people don't know why.
Yes, most people know about World War II and why the United States went into the war.
Of course.
So, with Pearl Harbor and everything else.
He doesn't know about Pearl Harbor.
Right. But World War I, you're absolutely right. It's like, well, now what was the reason? We're fighting the same people, but...
Okay, so I'll tell you, because I'm not going to put you on the spot. But the first reason was that the Lusitania was sunk by the German U-boats. And 128 American women and children perished in the sea. And it completely infuriated the public. But they kind of let it, they were isolationists, and they didn't really want to go to war. So they kind of let Wilson kind of keep bumping along. And then a telegram was intercepted from a German official to the German embassy in Washington that was supposed to get routed to the German embassy in Mexico City, suggesting very strongly to the Mexicans that if they attacked the U.S. on the southern border, when the Germans won, the German army would help them. But when they had victory, the Germans would give them back Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and southern California. And it's called the Zimmerman Memo. And I had no idea about the Zimmerman Memo. But once I read about it, I mean, and once Congress saw it, within 2 weeks, we had declared war on Germany. And it was very clever on Germany's part to try and distract the U.S. Army.
Oh, absolutely.
To the southern border and keep them out of Europe. Because once we got there, we want to help the French win the war.
Right. It's nefarious but clever. So.
Yeah. It was diabolical.
Yeah. Everybody knows, and I alluded to it in my opening of the show, everybody is familiar with the Jewish experience in World War II in one way or another. The evil involved from Nazi Germany to just how American soldiers who are Jewish participated, obviously, in the war. Little is known, at least generally speaking, little is known about World War I. So you were researching all of this, and you were combining aspects of Judaism or Jewish identity into your novel. And again, it's called Over There. And when you mix those elements together, did you find it hard initially to do it? Or did you take notes and you're doing your famous bullet points and then combining them all and then writing prose?
No, I have a kind of, I think every historical fiction writer has a certain method. And we overlap, but it's what works for us. And what works for me is while I'm going through that tedious process of editing a novel that's going to go out, that's written, I start researching the time period for the next novel and just start absorbing the setting, what was going on politically, what was going on fashion-wise, what was going on in the culture. And I start big And then I narrow in to the world that my characters, see, I already know who my characters are because they're in New York City. So I start like closing in to what was going on in the hospitals, how they were losing doctors right and left and nurses, because the medical teams were not conscripted. They went as volunteers, which surprised me. So then I started looking at what was happening with the Jewish community in New York. And I found a fascinating fact, which is what happens when you research is you find these like cute little rabbit holes. And this one was for some of my programs, I'm going to research this ethnic group by ethnic group. But I know that the Jewish population was about 3% of the United States in 1917. But 6% of Jews represented the army. So twice as many Jewish men enlisted or were conscripted, but more enlisted. And so I'm thinking, why? And so apparently, we didn't have legals and illegals then. They just weren't citizens. And the United States needed a big army. So they offered them a fast track to citizenship if they served. And you saw I started thinking, wow, so how much of the army was actually made up of immigrants? And it turns out that so many immigrants signed up for this, Italian, Greek, they were all double, triple their representation in the population, that they had to have special training camps to teach them English so that they could follow commands. And so it was a really interesting, as I said, little rabbit hole in history. And so, again, why? Were there other reasons? Sure. The Jews in particular were running away from people who were like killing them in Europe. And they were furious that they were so beaten down. And now they had an opportunity to fight back with bayonets and machine guns. I mean, who wouldn't go for that after having suffered so much? And so you had a lot of immigrants who were very thankful to be living in the United States, even though they were impoverished or they were climbing out of poverty by 1917. They felt safe and they wanted to protect their country, which is like really a beautiful thing. And When you fast forward to today, and I'm not going to connect all the dots, but there's a lot of dots to connect and a lot of ideas that we should be thinking about for illegal immigrants besides sending them down to Venezuela.
Does the research that you did in World War I in terms of the Jewish community, how much did that differ, the interaction and reaction and experience of the Jewish community during World War I as opposed to World War II? Did you find any difference in terms of when you were doing the research?
Well, I haven't researched World War II. So
no, from general knowledge that we all know.
I think as you very astutely pointed out in the beginning, so many Jews know so much more about World War II. It's still so present in a very saturated period of time for novels and so forth. I really wanted to stay away from World War II. That is a very crowded field of books. And I don't know from my experience if I have something unique to say unless I were to do a biography of my father and as a kid becoming a fighter pilot, and the PTSD that was never diagnosed that followed. So, I mean, that could be interesting, but there are a couple books like that out there. Mm-hmm. And so I was starting to go through this scanning process with my old family photographs, and I came upon pictures of my grandfather, Leo, in France. And it just kind of woke me up to a time that I didn't understand. And I thought that maybe this is where I put the next book. And I'm going to imagine his experience. And so where I had two books with female protagonists with Threadbare and In the Hands of Women, now I have four main characters. And although I have a super main character, Miriam, who is the nurse who finds a way to get to France, she is there with her uncle, who's a surgeon at Mount Sinai, an older surgeon. And she's there also with her brand new husband, who is a surgeon from Beth Israel, dealing with trauma surgery for the first time. Trauma like he'd never even had in his worst nightmares.
Yeah, that's a challenge, no doubt about it. Before I let you go, we only have a couple of minutes left. What do you want people to take away from the book? Because it's not a nonfiction book per se, in the sense that it's a novel. But sometimes there's a message, or more than one message, from a novel, just as there is in a nonfiction book. So, what would you like people to take away from reading Over There?
I really believe that World War I left Europe in shambles. And from those shambles grew Hitler. And I think that war leads to more wars, and that we really need to understand why we're in a war at all. War is hardwired into the human physiology. I don't know that we could ever avoid a war completely, but World War I is looked upon by most historians as folly. And I think we can learn from that. I also want them to stay invested in my characters, who really suffered in their own way as they had to deal with the emotional realities of war. And then what comes next for them when they are looking for peace in the country? And is there ever peace anywhere? And so I just think that it was an important link in my series, and it was important for me as an author to really explore this phenomena we call war.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Jane Loeb-Rubin. She's author of Over There, the third installment in her best-selling Gilded City trilogy. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Jane, go to janelobrubin.com and follow her on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Jane, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, I very appreciate you having me on your show.
Absolutely. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.